Sherwin and I both worked with Space City, which was Houston's first underground newspaper and a precursor to a lot of the stuff that is being done now, both in zines and in other in print publications, and also what's happening online. And so there's a lot to talk about in terms of what happened then and what's happening now. There's a few people here who were actually friends of ours back then, or even worked with us. I think since there's not, I think as much as possible we'll make this conversational if people want to, you know, just with give and take. I want to give you a little bit of background so you'll know the context of what we're talking about. In the 60s, as most of you know, some of you know very well, starting in the mid-60s, there was a major groundswell, cultural revolution of political sea change in this country. We were kind of in the middle of that. I graduated from high school. We both graduated. We're both about the same age. We're both 82. But we came of age in the mid-60s. And at that time, the Vietnam War movement and the kind of counterculture, the psychedelic movement, the new music, all of these things, the civil rights struggle, all that stuff came to a head to create this incredible sense of change, of anticipation, of commitment among especially young people in this country, which grew and grew and grew to where it became a major, pretty much resistance movement in the late 60s and early 70s. Something that happened just out of the blue, well, one thing that happened was the offset press was invented. And because of the offset press, it became easier and less expensive to print publications. And you could do it in a much higher quality than it had been possible before. And so all of these, as a result of this ferment that was happening in the country, all these papers started popping up all over the place. You know, they grew independently. One of the very earliest was a paper that we started in Austin called The Rag, which was basically Houston, it came from a Houston conspiracy. Most of us were from Houston, people from Bel Air High School, who came to Austin, and we started this paper, and it was a very important force. It was one of the most influential of what became several hundred newspapers. In fact, they were all over the world. All of these newspapers that popped up independently, there were some of them were like the San Francisco Oracle, which was this gorgeous paper with splint font printing, all these beautiful colors. The print was all kind of obscured. You didn't read much, but it was beautiful. And they did stuff that had never been done with tabloid newspapers. Then there were papers that did a lot of serious political reporting. There were papers that came out of the cultural community. There were papers that came out of campus communities. Eventually, there were GI anti-war papers. There were high school underground papers. There were just all kinds of underground papers. Because of a wonderful sort of... There was a lot of people did theater in this period of time. The Yippies were famous, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, and stuff. You created myths. Well, one myth that was created was the myth of the underground press syndicate. You know, there was actually I'm going to show you guys something. The underground press syndicate was this was the first meeting of the underground press syndicate in Stinson Beach, California. That's me right there on the left. And the thing that what the underground press syndicate did was it said it created the idea that there was this incredible organization of all these underground papers, but basically what we did was say, all the underground papers are going to relate to each other. We're going to all have free reprint rights. We're going to all mail to each other, send each other free subscriptions. And so what happened was that it created this network. And I say it was a myth because it wasn't a big organization, but it was much bigger than if there had been. And then there was a thing called Liberation News Service, which was like a news service for underground newspapers that printed material that you didn't find anywhere else. The underground press was responsible for talking about the Vietnam War in ways that no one else had talked about it, and it resulted in the mass media, the mainstream media, starting to have to deal with the criticisms of the Vietnam War. We brought to the surface a little bit of a comprehension of what was happening with the cultural movement, what the drug and long hair stuff was really all about, and the fact that it wasn't just, you know, what people now, I mean, it's hard for people to understand at this point what was happening then. It's just very hard to communicate it. You know, and whenever you see stuff when you see movies where they deal with people in the 60s, hippies, we never called ourselves hippies, we were freaks. We don't we didn't know what hippies meant. It's always stereotypical. It's always the headband with the hair, you know, and the girl with the flower dress. And, you know, the fact is that it was there was a major fabric that out of which this grew and that held us all together. And it was a commitment to a different kind of, to trying to create a different kind of world and to do it in a way that we also changed our own lives and changed the way we interacted with each other. So anyway, the underground press happened. All these paper stories going on, all just popping together and then interacting. Until it actually was the primary, I think the primary force in building what became a major resistance movement in this country. And it was unprecedented. And the underground press was unprecedented in the history of journalism. And they're starting to recognize that now. There's a lot of textbooks that are starting to deal with the underground press. Nothing like that had ever happened before. And like I said, part of it was because of technology, just as now we're dealing with a new technology that is creating all kinds of new potential and who knows what, danger, you know, in online journalism. We started, and I'm going to try to pull this together, we started the RAG. The RAG is what was like the sixth or seventh underground paper in the country and was the first one to grow out of a community of committed activist people. It pulled together that kind of drug culture and that political culture into a force in Austin, and that was primarily in Austin, that was one of the biggest, one of the major kind of centers for resistance in the country, for counterculture. And those of us who started the RAG, several of us were then involved in starting Space City in Houston. Space City was run by a collective. Sherwood lived in the Space City office and had some wonderful tales to tell. It was a different environment, a totally different kind of thing, because Houston was not as friendly a community as Austin, which has always had that kind of big counterculture. Houston was different, and Houston had a major Ku Klux Klan, which was very tightly interwoven with the Houston Police Department. But the main thing about Houston, it was all spread out. There was no Houston there. It was just community, little bits and pieces everywhere. Houston is much more of a city now than it was then. So what Space City did was to help to identify all these pockets of, you know, progressive politics and kindred spirits and help to pull them together into a cohesive unit. And as a result, what spun out of Space City was high school underground newspapers, food co-ops, all these alternative organizations and this whole network of countercultural stuff. So anyway, and we were run as a collective. We did not have an editor. We did not have a leader. We all worked together. Editorial. Sure, why don't you take over? Sherwood has a bunch of copies of different underground papers and stuff.
Show and tell. So
and he had an organizational structure for me, but I'm sure I didn't even touch it.
So there were lots of publications that were sort of radical or specialized before the underground press developed. This is a later copy of The Militant. And this is Granma in Cuba, not the most graphically friendly thing. There were magazines. This is Ramparts and Win and Liberation Magazine. In Houston, had been for decades newspapers like The Informer, which is not a name anyone would have used for a newspaper in the 60s, but it was the Informer was a Houston black community newspaper established early in the last century, but it was just focused for the black community, as did the Forward Times. There were Hispanic community newspapers that were essentially only read by Hispanic people, typically had lots of Spanish text in them, gay newspapers that focused on those communities. An important
Some
thing about
on a table over there.
Right, yeah. Well, most of these, all the gay ones and
this week in Texas.
Old copies of The Informer and The Forward Times on the table over there by Ann Stovo. And when the first underground newspaper started coming out, so here's one, the Berkeley Tribe, which was one of the very first ones. And then I'm not sure what order they came out in. The Great Speckled Bird from Atlanta.
Which I think we were the first and they were the second in the South.
The Chicago right. Seed. Eventually there was the Black Panther newspaper, which was read by not just Black Panthers, but by lots of other people. There were tons of newspapers in New York, the East Village, other, and lots of others. This is the New York City Star, one of the lesser known ones. In Dallas, there was the Dallas Notes from the Underground, which then was replaced by Iconoclast. All of these are in the late 60s, early 70s, whatever. Eventually, there were towns just about everywhere that had papers. So this is from Denton, Texas, the New World Press from Denton. So these even little towns had these things. And, of course, you had eventually things like all of the comic books. So this is, really...
Before you go on, I want to throw in something else,
okay,
too, because you're showing the political, like the Militant and things like that, that were antecedents of the Underground Press. Mad Magazine was an antecedent to the Underground Press. The Village Voice, Paul Krasner's The Realist. A lot of stuff that was really outrageous and culturally outrageous, a lot of different kind of things. It wasn't just the politics. So a lot of things came together. But go ahead.
And then, of course, there was the Daily Cougar at the University of Houston, which this is from November of 69, which is Peace Day Tracks 2000, so that's impressive for Houston. An important thing, though, that the Underground Press did is it reached out to all those communities. So you had lots of articles on what was going on in the gay community, Hispanics, Blacks, young kids, labor stuff, and things like this. So here's one from 1970 of... the Hispanic activity, sort of leaders of the action in that community.
Mexican American Youth Organization.
Mayo. Yeah. There's another article over there about when Mayo took over a church on the north side when I went in and we stayed in there and played music on the organ church and the House of the Rising Sun and stuff like that. There were lots of Blacks were involved in it, and this newspaper also did, the Space City did lots of very serious investigative journalism or muckraking, whatever you want.
Power structure research, too.
Right. So, and we brought in celebrities like Jane Fonda and Arlo Guthrie and lots of people like that that would come in and attract people that might not otherwise be attracted or be involved in things, and it was a way a lot of people sort of networked. We did have lots of cartoon covers and things that were culturally based. But here's an article that we did on the Jesse Jones empire, how it related to local universities and with the financing and how the university and the power structure used it to train people for the kinds of things that they wanted to get for making money. In-depth articles on Brown and Root and on their whole structure, which of course now leads right up to Dick Cheney, who was the head of Kellogg's KBR, Kellogg's Brown and Root, before he became vice president.
And incidentally, in relation to this, a lot of the powers that be tended to ignore us, but sometimes we got a little bit irritated. And Louis Welch, who was the mayor of Houston one time, said to the city council that Space City wasn't worth wrapping fish in. So we consider that a great...
An article here on pollution and on the relationship between pollution and profit making. And then following Space City, although I'll get into exactly what the one outgrowth of it was, other newspapers that related to specific communities, like this one that Chris worked on, right? Little Red Schoolhouse, which was a high school newspaper. So one thing that happened was that there were high school students, lots of them, they would come into the Space City office, as did hitchhikers from out of town and lots of people. They'd get Space Cities and they could sell them and make money. And so there were all these high school students that were taking the Space City out to their high schools, and of course they got busted and they were going to kick them out of school and whatever, and the high school students ended up getting together and starting their own newspaper and taking things to court on freedom of speech basis and winning lots of cases. And I have lots of Space Cities, but maybe you want to talk some more.
Incidentally, in terms of that, the RAG, when the RAG started in Austin, the RAG tried to sell on campus in the University, and the University, of course, immediately everybody freaked out, pushed us off the campus. Well, it was eventually, they formally forbid the rag to sell on campus, and the rag went to court, and it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court decided in favor of the rag. So we were involved in making law, too, or establishing law, or you know.
We broke a few, too.
We broke a few laws, too. Well, that's very true. Russ.
If you want to make an omelet.
Most of us, and you can see there's the big staff, Space City staff picture on the wall over there from 71, I think. Most of us look a lot weirder than here down here and stuff, except for Russ, who actually looks straighter than, because he sold advertising for
and paid the bills.
And paid the bills, yeah. What I think, you know, there's a lot we can talk about, and we've gone on, and we've already been talking all day today. We did a world history interview for the library, and we did some television stuff and things. We talk a lot. We're very good. But I'd like to open it up.
I'd like to show some Space Cities just so we see more.
I'd like to know what other people want to talk about, I think, or, you know, want to ask. Yeah.
I come from a very square daily newspaper background, so I was kind of curious about some of the newsroom culture that you had. You sound like you have some kind of weird power structure, not really a power structure, more kind of thing. So I was kind of curious about how
we made decisions.
Yeah.
We worked together collectively, and we came to consensus. But that doesn't mean that everybody. Sometimes we a different person on the collective would actually be the editor, you know, one week, or, you know, we take different roles. It's just that one of the things we tried to do in those days, because, you know, we were dealing with interpersonal stuff, because this all affected us, it was our lives as well as our profession, or it wasn't our profession, because you make money if you're in a music profession. But so we wanted to deal with the fact that generally men dominated women at that point in time. So we wanted to create structures where it would guarantee that the women involved would have an equal role in the paper. You know, there's a lot of that. But you know, as far as making decisions, as far as the journalism, one thing I want to say about the journalism is that, and this is something that I think we were a precursor to a lot of other personalized journalism happened. We didn't believe that there was such a thing as objectivity. We thought objectivity was a thing that was used as a crutch, and that everybody has an axe to grind. And the difference between what we did and what the commercial media did primarily was that we showed our biases up front, and we tried to be honest. We told the truth. We were trying to be accurate, but people knew where we were coming from, and that was the difference with the commercial media in this country. You didn't know where they were coming from, but they were coming from making money. They were coming from connections to the corporate. To the corporate structure and to the business, because the media was the business, and so that's how it is. You know, another thing that I should say in terms of traditional journalism, and there were people who worked on Space City, you know, the Rag, who became journalists. Dennis Fitzgerald worked at the Houston Chronicle. Victoria Smith, on the other hand, had worked at the St. Paul Dispatch before she came to work. So I mean, there was a lot of my stuff. But we, both at the Rag in Austin and at Space City in Houston, we had people from the straight media contacting us continually. We had people who wrote stuff for us under assumed names, people who slipped us information all the time. So we had a strength. And the other thing too is that people would come to do, like Sherwood was saying, people would come to sell newspapers, and they would get involved in the process, and they would learn how to do it. We were all learning it as we went along. You know, cut and paste back then. You know. You know, I'll never lose that smell of rubber cement. You know, from way out there, the early days before we even had wax machines. You know, so.
Which is still a big advantage of the offset press. You could just cut and paste stuff and then take a photograph of it and print directly from that. You didn't have to worry about a big linotype machine or heavy equipment.
When we started the Rag, in fact, we had our own printing press, but it was kind of comic book format. Comic book size, because that's the size we could do it with the printing press that we had. So it was actually it was actually done out of Larry Freudiger's house. You know, and you know, the floor was full of, I mean, it was that high with newspaper discarded papers that were smeared and stuff.
One big thing that happened as far as Anne's question is that that's very relevant to what's happening today, is that at Space City we were very interested in doing some of the articles, like looking into the power structure, asking questions that the established papers didn't want to ask, And because we lived at the newspaper and were supported by it, even if we lived at
and dodged the Klan's bullets
and dodged the office, whatever
they literally shut up the office.
We had the time and the capability to spend weeks or sometimes months working on a story that involved a whole lot of investigation and research. And of course, there's a big problem with that happening now, with newspapers disappearing, the large print newspapers disappearing, with broadcast media being turned into money-making things where the news departments are being cut down so that there's less and less opportunities to have people that can really do detailed investigation. And there you have lots of people on doing blogs and things where they can write about what they're interested in, but there's a very huge lack of financial support to pay somebody's salary while they spend months doing some sort of investigative
story. And an ironic thing there is for a while people were saying that the whole blogosphere, all the internet news reporting, well, they were just reporting on stuff that the newspapers, you know, they were picking up and running from the newspaper. Well, now it's working the opposite way because all the beat reporters are losing their beats. The people who are, the bureaus are being closed down. So what's happening now is that the people who actually are staying around and following a story are online journalists. And so now newspapers are turning to the internet quite frequently for news leads. Yep.
What was the relationship between Space City News and KPFT?
I worked at both of them. They were the two forces. They were combined interactive forces in terms of they reached different audiences to some extent, but for the most part, they both played a role of pulling the community together and informing the community.
KPFT came down the road, though.
Yeah, we were before KPFT. But the interesting thing, too, is that, I mean, you know, we both suffered the slings and arrows of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. You know, the KPFT, which was, for those of you who don't, you probably know, because it's still going, the Pacifica radio station, was bombed off the air by the Ku Klux Klan. The transmitter was bombed off the air twice. And we had cars firebombed. And Sherwood lived in the office, so Sherwood had to, you know, deal with it. Where a bullet shot into
there was a crossbow that was shot.
An arrow from a crossbow with a sticker on it that said, "The Knights of the Ku Klux Klan is watching you."
And a hand grenade landed right in my feet one time. And they threw a hand grenade in the front door, and it landed at my feet. And I just thought it was a stink bomb. I was going to pick it up and throw it out in the yard. But I heard the guy running off, and I went off chasing him. And it blew it out of the windows and everything. And
yeah. And there would be stuff like that that would happen, and we'd see police cars down in each corner. Back in those days, it's not just paranoia. The Houston police and the Ku Klux Klan recruited the same people. They recruited in the same East Texas towns. They recruited people with the same sensibilities and the same needs, often sadistic needs. And so the Ku Klux Klan, I mean, it's now recognized that, I mean, there was a major infiltration in the Houston Police Department by the Ku Klux Klan. It wasn't until Fred Hoffmeins was mayor that there was an attempt to actually change that, to try to rid the Houston Police Department of the Klan.
Ironically, a lot of those things that the Klan did sort of has led to their downfall also, because Houston got lots of really bad news for having all these Klan activities, and there were people on, you know, the late night talk shows making jokes about Klan activity in Houston. And so the power structure in Houston got to think, well, this is making our city look really bad. We have to do something about it because it's going to cost us money.
Houston was never a really heavy-duty, racist, right-wing southern city. It never was. Houston did not have an enlightened power structure, but it had a power structure that tried to, like, make things work. And that's why integration happened in Houston much more smoothly than it did in many places, because they all just got together. Houston was run by a few good old boys. And they just got together and made a decision that they would integrate the schools, and they came up with a plan to do it. You know, a couple of years, a couple of grades at a time, and there were no incidents at all, virtually none, in Houston. So they didn't want that kind of publicity. You know, Houston's always been a kind of contradictory place. You know, we were talking earlier about the gay community in Houston. There's always been an open gay community all the way back, and there's always been a lot, I think, of tolerance for alternative lifestyles in Houston. Although there was always a serious right wing, too, that you had to deal with. So, anyway, what else? Anybody? Anything of anybody interested? Is anybody here working? Or do some of you people work on zines or work on online stuff or anything like that? Is there anything that you feel is you're interested in how those things correspond or how it's different? Because I think there's real questions about, I mean, because the online reality is in some ways so totally different, and we don't have any idea what it means yet. You know, does it help us bring community together? Does it help us to network? Or is it alienating? Does it separate us from each other? You know, I mean, it's an incredible phenomenon, and the difference is that what we did, we were community centers. Every underground newspaper was a community center. It pulled in dozens and dozens and dozens of people who came and hung out at the offices, got involved, started working. The internet tends to make you sort of off into your own virtual reality. But on the other hand, the networking potential, the communication potential is so incredible. So fast, you know. So that's there's real questions about how this thing, how, what's happening now.
The central aspect of what Space City and KPFT both were is the fact that they were local and centers of local community. So I had several shows on KPFT over the years, and Thorne probably did too, where we would talk about very local kinds of issues and news about what was going on that week in Houston in different areas. And Space City had articles about all of those things, so it really pulled things together. And I think that's something that's a real challenge for any net-based things going on right now, is how do you make it local? How do you make it pull things together so that people are sharing information that's geographically based, that has some aspect to it where people actually are getting together off the web, getting together in person and taking activities to doing things, and I think that's a real challenge.
I did a show on KPFT called The Briar Patch. It was a weekly interview show, and we didn't have talk radio back then. You didn't have, I mean, some commercial radio stations would have one talk show because they had some kind of public service requirement, and so they would have a talk show at 2 in the morning on Saturday night, you know, or Sunday morning. That would be their, you know, their contribution. So, but anyway, so we were, it was kind of unique, and we did call-ins and we did interviews and stuff. And talking about the ways we tie it in with issues and stuff. There was an issue with the dogs, dope sniffing dogs in high schools one time, and they were the cops. I remember where that was. It was in Harris County, but it wasn't in the Houston School District. Anyway, they went out with dogs and went and had the dogs sniff all the lockers and to find dope. And the kids were outraged, and it became a major issue. A lot of the parents were outraged, and so we did a show about it on KPFT where we had. You know, I don't know, we had somebody from that school district and we had some of the kids and we had a dog or two, I don't know. And I mean, that show we went on for 2 hours overtime. That was one thing that you could do, you know, sometimes. We just kept going. We went into the night with phone calls. Everybody was calling. So we dealt with issues, community issues and things like that. And it was very interconnected with, because a lot of those people that a lot of those high school kids were people who we already knew, who we also knew because of Space City. Yeah.
I have a sort of historical one, which was that in reading about the People's Party 2 and the standoff that happened in Dowling Street, it mentioned that a lot of the coordination of defense of the party headquarters was being coordinated through the Space City News, of like the call was supposed to go there or something. Do y'all know much about that? Or
Sherwood was more involved in that. I do know that we were, I mean,
I'm sorry, what?
Much of the People's Party 2 and the relationship of defense in the Space City, I mean, we were very closely involved with them. You know, I know Sherwood worked with Carl Hampton, who was shot by the Houston police. And yeah, we worked, I mean, that cover of Space City, which is over there on the wall when Carl was shot, became a poster, was used all over the place by people in support. I don't know whether stuff was organized. I mean, I don't even know all the stuff that was organized out of Space City. It was like, I mean,
We had articles that they could write themselves that were local articles. So they sold the Black Panther newspaper, but that was a national newspaper. They didn't have local stuff. And they called themselves People's Party 2, assuming that the Black Panthers were People's Party 1 in that sense. The main projects of People's Party 2 were a community clinic, a community library, those kinds of things. That's what they really wanted to do.
Yeah, that's what the Black Panthers made money on. Buster was feeding kids. I mean, you know.
The problem was that
these were terrible, you know.
The power structure and the police didn't want them to do that. And they sort of said, oh, that's just like they said with us, oh, they're commies, they're, you know, subversives, and we have to do whatever we can to try and stop them. They did the same thing with People's Party, too, of confronting them, arresting people that were out selling the Black Panther or Space City. And so I think our working with them on some of those projects, in some cases, helped provide them with a little bit of coverage because they were a little bit less likely to attack places where whites were than they were if there were only blacks.
Yeah. So we gave
and we worked on this project. And the same thing with Mayo and the Hispanic things. There was a real close relationship with all of those organizations, each one having their own thing and their own projects, but still in this big community that was working on anti-war stuff, civil rights, things dealing with Black and Hispanic communities and gay and lesbian and feminist things, they were all mixed together. And it was the same with the Black Panthers, so that they eventually had to deal with issues of feminism and the Black Panthers, for example, that were difficult for them to deal with.
They never really dealt with that very well.
But they publicly sort of
they did have to deal with them. Women in the Black Panther
Party. And so there was a lot of mixture of the different issues.
One thing is that, you know, the police obviously didn't just attack the Black Panthers and People's Party because they were doing community. They also had all this revolutionary rhetoric, and they had an internationalist perspective, and so they tied everything into, you know, tied the issues together. And so it was, you know, so, and had a very militant front. You know, they had this, and part of what they were trying to do was to create a sense of a positive sense among Black people. And at that time, of course, everybody thought that you had to be armed. You know, there was all this stuff about armed revolution, which is, you know, when you look back on it, you know, how real was that? That's, you know, if you're ever going to change this country, you're not going to do it through armed insurrection. But still, it was part of that was to give people a sense of empowerment.
The People's Party sort of said, this is our community, talking about Third Ward and the Black communities. This is our community. We're not going to back down. We're going to go and do things to help develop our community. And the power structure, especially the Houston Police Department, said, hell no, this is our community. We own it. And so they just went in very brutal ways just to wipe them out.
That's what I was going to say, that what I remember was that the police presence around Third Ward and on Dowling was just massive and constant. I remember going over to the People Party headquarters one time, and I've forgotten who I was with, but we were harassed by the police. Just, you know, I was 17, 18, and these guys said things to me that I'd never, ever heard in my life, the police. And when we went to the People's Party headquarters, and went inside, we were talking, I forgot what we were doing, but there was a lot of talk inside that there was something getting ready to go down with the police. And they said, you know, you may want to go back over to Space City because this may involve guns. And they were cleaning guns and getting things ready. And I'm going, okay. All right, should we stay or should we go? But
one of the reasons for staying was to give them cover.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And you really can't underestimate the police presence out there and how oppressive it was.
Herman
and then there
Short.
Was the Herman Short, and there was the John Brown Revolutionary Society. You remember them? And they were a mostly Caucasian group that was working with People's Party, a little bit more militant than.
And the people in power, Herman Short, and the police chief. These were real. Now these guys were yahoos.
Yeah.
You know, these guys were openly racist, you know, and at that time you had people disappearing, you know, people, cops stopping people and they suddenly disappeared into the bio and stuff. I mean, there was, you know, from that end of things, Houston was a wild west town at that time. But anybody else? Yeah.
More of a comment, but I just, you know, you were talking about the blogs and online versus, like, what you guys had then. I mean, yeah, there's similarities, but, like, one really unfortunate difference, I think, is that those papers, like, have a life. Like, even now, like, you can hold them in your hand, And, like, I mean, and I think it really affected people's consciousness, too, because in a way that we get everything immediately, and if it's not immediate, like, it's just gone.
That's right.
And, you know, a paper like that could, I don't know, find its way eventually to, like, a bathroom, I don't know, Berkeley or Arkansas or wherever, like, months later, and someone could just pick it up and would still, like, maybe it would still be relevant. And, you know, something 3 or 4 months old would still be relevant now, like 3 or 4 years old.
And it was interesting because we didn't have large circulation, but you had incredible multiple readership with underground newspapers. They went around. Lots of people read every issue. You know, they could find them all dog-eared and read, you know. And also the immediacy. I mean, of course, I grew up in a, you know, my father was a newspaper man, and I grew up around print, you know, and I collect books. And, you know, I've got to have stuff that I hope that I can spill my coffee on in the morning. I mean, you know, and so, and there is, you're right, there just is an incredible difference. There's also a difference in the youth community or in young, in our culture that makes things, people say, well, why don't we have any of that kind of commitment? Why don't we have any of that sort of rebellion now? And a lot of it is because you can't leave school for a year and, you know, go to Europe anymore. Or you can't live, you know, on, you know, subsistence, you know, level or live on just out of poverty, because back then, if you didn't have any money, everybody took care of you. You know, there were communes. You hit, I'm sure I was mentioning earlier, you hitchhike through town, there's always somebody who's going to put you up. You didn't have these incredible student loans, so that as soon as you graduated from school, you had to work and you had, you know, there wasn't that kind of cutthroat. We're at such a different kind of political and economic and cultural environment. It's, and I think there's also a cynicism. There was a loss of innocence as a result of what happened in the 60s and 70s. Because we really, honestly, dropped out. We committed ourselves to this thing. And there's and even though we look at it now, we see there were a lot of changes. There are a lot of things that happened directly as a result of what we did. Still, it seemed we didn't change the damn world. You know, and we got tired. And it ended up that the movement, as it grew older, turned in on itself. There was incredible repression from the government, from the FBI, the COINTELPRO program, all of this kind of stuff, which all these things went together, and we were just tired. So it went together to make, you know, to create this kind of sense of, you know, a sense of failure. There were a lot of suicides, you know, Abby Hoffman kind of things, but not people that were that well known, speaking. And so it's people now are more cynical. People are less likely to ride with a dream. There's less idealism, I think, you know.
Thorne, don't you think, though, that because it took so many of us working in one way or another to make it happen, that we had a sense of mutual support, that I think people working alone at a computer may not feel? I mean, we actually had to physically be together.
That was a big part of it, is also the fact that we could easily identify ourselves, our community, by the way that we looked. Because we all looked like freaks. We had long hair, was the way that we dressed and everything. And so you could go in the Montrose area and there would be thousands of people you'd see in the street and cafes and all. I mean, in the Montrose area at that time, it still makes me sad just to think of it. There were so many head shops and little, you know, freak cafes and businesses of all sorts and just all along all these streets, and you could go around.
To say nothing of what happened in the houses and apartments that were, and, you know, the communes, the, you know, kind of
right,
collective stuff.
And just all kinds of communes everywhere. And all those people were your family, potential lovers. Each commune like that was a potential home for you, all of those things. And not only that, but it was, you know, eventually it was the whole country was that way. So I hitchhiked back and forth across the country numerous times from here to the East Coast and the West Coast. And you could stop in little towns. Now, of course, it was also dangerous, because if you're going through the South or something, you had people threatening to run over you and tie you up and cut your hair or whatever. But also, there were the freaks in every little town. And they knew you, you know, they'd give you a ride
they didn't have
and a place to crash, and, you know, food and whatever. There was this whole community that just spanned the whole country like that, of, you know, millions of people eventually.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to ask about, this is a different subject, but with newspapers sort of fading away little by little and online coming on now, what do you all think about investigative journalism? I mean, a lot of people are saying, oh, this is the death of investigative journalism.
Well, you know what? One thing we have to realize is that the newspapers in this kind of, the news business has failed us miserably. The newspapers, the journalism, American journalism missed the two biggest stories of our time, Iraq and the economy. They didn't see any of it. You know, they let all the lies about Iraq happen. No, there was nothing. You know, all the, whatever was done sort of by independent journalists. You know. And the economy, the fact that all of that pyramid scheme Ponzi stuff was going on everywhere, all over that the whole network, and the media did not pick up on it. So the media's, you know, a lot of the lack of respect in the media is legitimate, given that the media has kept people on all kinds of levels without print media. Without real serious journalism, it's hard to find, you know, to keep those local politicians honest, even vaguely honest, to find, you know, at least the most extreme examples of whatever. And I don't know how much the internet's going to be able to do that. The other thing that's going on right now, and the whole discussion with journalism, is trying to find new financial models, trying to find new ways to support newspapers without their having to be dependent upon advertising, ways for them to survive in difficult economies, and whether that's some kind of public support, which then creates all kinds of new ties, you know, whether it's some kind of cooperatives, something. There's a lot of discussion going on right now about creating new financial models for newspapers. I'm interested to know what other people think about how much the internet can move in. Yeah. You stole my art car shirt.
well, how did the Space City New